Well, I've been asked to speak on two subjects, and to do it in 40 minutes is a big task, because to talk about capitalism and what it is, which is a system which has existed for several centuries, and if I've got 40 minutes, that means 20 minutes for that, and to talk about socialism, which we aspire to as a future society which we hope will last some time, also will take a lot of time. So I won't be able to go into the details of everything, but I'm going to try and give out an outline of what capitalist society is and what we believe the alternative to that is. And before I go on, as Timur said, I'm one of the editors of a website called Marxist.com, and it is the website, it's called In Defense of Marxism, the website. It's the website of the International Marxist Tendency, which is an international organization. It's a political organization. Its aim is to struggle for the ideas of Marxism in all countries of the world, and to struggle for these ideas to become the ideas of the labor movement, of the workers' parties, of the workers' organizations, the leaders of the labor movement internationally. Now, the fact that I don't know how many meetings you've been to this kind. The fact that so many people turn up at Freshers' Fair to listen to somebody talking about Marxism, and it's this number of people, is actually significant. Yesterday I was in Southampton, and I spoke at the university there. And again, big interest, and young people looking for answers to what's happening in the world. Because I think we may not agree on what the solution is, but I think everybody has the sense that there's something profoundly wrong with the world that we live in. A world with immense wealth, immense development of technology, and at the same time, people dying of hunger, wars, killing children, ordinary people, on our TV screens practically every day. And there's a reason for this. Now, it's not just the world gone mad, or as some might say, it's the indication that the world is about to end, as some people think. It's an indication of the deep malaise within capitalist society, and it's a consequence of this society. Now, it's not by chance. Now, there's significant turnout here, but the interest in Marxism is actually growing in the recent period, and has been for some years. Here's an article from The Guardian from last year, and it's why Marxism is on the rise again. And it explains the revival in interest in Marx and Marxist thought. That's on The Guardian. In an obscure economic website, where's Grantham, Jeremy Grantham, who's a finance whiz kid, he says that capitalism threatens our existence. This is a capitalist speaking, not a socialist. And the article refers to the fact that already capitalism is proving that Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels were at least partially correct. Now, why they add the word partially, you have to understand, is that the limits they will go to on Marx is to say, well, he had an interesting analysis of capitalism, and he explained a lot about the mechanisms of capitalism, but his conclusions were somewhat wrong, i.e., Marx didn't just analyse capitalism, he indicated where it would lead, and that it would lead to a huge crisis, out of which humanity would only be able to come through actually removing the system, capitalism itself. Now, they talk about Marxism, or they have for a long time, Marxism being out of date and Marx being dead. I've never heard so many announcements that a person is dead as I have in reference to Karl Marx. I always thought if somebody's dead, you announce his death once and that's it. You bury him and he's finished. Now, it's over 100 years and they keep saying he's dead. Why do you have to keep announcing that he's dead? Very clearly, it's because his ideas are not dead. His ideas are very relevant to the situation. Now, there are periods when it can seem to be true. I was born in such a period. I was born in the 50s, brought up in the 60s, and it was the height of the boom of capitalism. And you might have understood why some people might have thought then that Marx was wrong. But if you live in the world of today, and you see what's happening all over the world today, you understand that well, maybe as these articles say, maybe Marx was right. Now, I advise that there's an article here called Actually Marx Was Right. It's on our website, published in November 2011 by Alan Woods, who will come and speak here. And he refers to this phenomenon of these articles that keep popping up about how right he was. Now, I'll just read you something written by Karl Marx, and tell me if this doesn't refer to what we're going through today. It says, "It is enough to mention the commercial crises that by their periodical return put the existence of the entire bourgeois society on its trial, each time more threateningly. In these crises, a great part not only of the existing products, but also the previously created productive forces are periodically destroyed. In these crises, there breaks out an epidemic that in all earlier epochs would have seemed an absurdity, the epidemic of overproduction. Society suddenly finds itself put back into a state of momentary barbarism. It appears as if a famine, a universal war of devastation, had cut off the supply of every means of subsistence. Industry and commerce seem to be destroyed. And why? Because there is too much civilization, too much means of subsistence, too much industry, too much commerce." And he goes on and explains the crisis of the system. Now, this was written in the 1840s. Now, you would think, I would challenge you to go and find any economic analyst from that period and read what they said, the bourgeois analysts, and see whether it's relevant or not. You take this, written by Marx, and it's in the Communist Manifesto, and it explains exactly the crisis that we're in today. Now, on the question of what is capitalism, you see, capitalism hasn't always existed. Now, we are taught, we're brought up in a society to believe that the world is as it is and as always has been, and that human nature is what it is, and it's always been like this, and it always will be. And the idea behind that is you can't change the world. And yet, if we look at the history of the world, we see that it's changed many times. We don't have slaves anymore, except in some parts of the world they still do. But in general, slavery was abolished a long time ago. We don't have serfs who work the land of the Lord and can't leave the land. They're tied to the land. We have a different economic system. It's called capitalism, which is a system in which you are free, in the sense that you're free to seek the employer that will give you a job. That's your freedom. You're free to try and get the best job possible, and you're free to ask for as much as you can get. Of course, the capitalist then points out to you that you're not as free as you think, because he doesn't give you what you aspire to getting. He gives you what he thinks you're worth paying for. Now, when capitalism came into existence, the bourgeois economists, people like Smith, Ricardo, others, were honestly trying to work out how this system works. Because let's go back to the previous system, feudalism. It was based fundamentally on the ownership of land. The lord of the manor owned the land. He had all these serfs to whom he gave a piece of land each. And this system was based on, you work 3 days on your land and 3 days on my land. Now, the 3 days on your land was to provide the food and for your family. Basically, you were working for yourself. But you were only allowed to do that on that piece of land in exchange for working 3 days on the land of the landlord, who then took all the produce from that land as his. So it's quite simple, quite easy to see that there was a kind of 50% exploitation, in the sense that half the work of a serf was done for the landlord, and everything done in those 3 days went to the landlord, and that's where the wealth came from. It's quite easy to analyse, let's say, as a system. Capitalism comes into being within feudalism. And by the way, the capitalists of today and their system, they abhor violence, except when they have to bomb Syria or Iraq or a few other places. But they abhor violence. Violence, of course, of workers on strike, maybe, in a picket line. But when it comes to the big wars, they forget their non-violence. Their non-violence is, the workers must be non-violent, so they don't threaten our system. We're allowed to be as violent as we want. But on the question of how the system works and how it came into being, the French capitalist regime, let's call it, the Republic, how did it come into being? It didn't come into being with a friendly discussion with the king, as far as I remember. You've all done your history. You don't have to be a genius to remember what happened to the French king in the French Revolution. You don't have to be a genius to remember what Cromwell did to Charles in the so-called Civil War. Capitalism came into existence through revolutions, which were necessary to overthrow the landed aristocracy under feudalism, which resisted that change. In order for society to move forward, that is, from feudalism to capitalism, and nobody can argue that capitalism is inferior, it's enormously developed the means of production, it's enormously developed science and technique, etc., and has brought humanity forward. But it came into being through a series of revolutions. But once it was established as a system, when the factories developed, industry developed, commerce, trade, etc., the question was asked by economists who were trying to understand how the system worked. And the reason they tried to understand it is because every now and then, this system tended to go into crisis. There were these periodical, these cycles of ups and downs in the economy, periods of growth, followed by periods of crisis, closures, unemployment, growing poverty, and then booms again. So it's logical that humanity would ask itself, why is this? How does it work? Now, the big question is, how do the capitalists make their profits? How do capitalists make their profit? I mean, is it because, I don't know, I go buy these glasses for £10 and then I sell them to you for 20. That's a good way of making profit. But I would say he'd obviously be stupid to buy them off me. Why doesn't he go and buy them where I bought them for £10? Which is what normally would happen. But yet there's still profit being made. Where's it coming from? Now, what Marx pointed out is where the profit comes from and what consequences this has for the whole of society. Now, Marx touched on the question of value. What is value? How do you work out the value of any particular product? None of you would swap a biro pen for a Rolls Royce, would you? I mean, you wouldn't say a pen is the same value as a Rolls Royce. Why? What is it that makes the two things so different? Well, simply, the amount of labour time necessary to produce one or the other. And it's the amount of labour time which determines the value, because the only thing which produces new value in an economy is human labour power. It's human beings actually applying themselves in work. And I'll give you some example. You have a tree. It's no good saying there's a tree out there, but you want a table to be able to eat on. That tree has got to be transformed into a table. And it won't become a table by itself. Somebody has to cut it down, has to cut it into planks, it has to be transported, it has to be worked, it has to be shaped until it finally becomes a table. And then it becomes something which you want, which is a table, because you need the table in your living room to eat off. Now, in the process from tree to table, there's a whole series of workers intervening and applying labour time. And every time they do that, it's a cost. That worker has to be paid, whether it's an hour, a day, or 2 days, or whatever. And the wood in itself, if it's standing there as a tree, is simply a tree. The coal under the ground has no value whatsoever until somebody digs down, digs tunnels, digs it out, takes it out, and then it's available to be used in a blast furnace or whatever to make steel, etc. So everything that is useful to human beings, apart from the natural, the air, even that is starting to cost these days with the pollution. Water, which is a natural thing we have to pay for nowadays, that's how far capitalism has gone. But generally speaking, the goods that we use, everything that makes for a civilized existence, the shirts we wear, the shoes, the bags, everything, has to be produced. Now, here's the capitalist system. How does it work? The capitalist why do we call him a capitalist? Because he owns capital, which means he has the money and the machinery, the factories, the means of production. And he requires these means of production to be set in motion to create the goods that people want. Marx referred to producing things which have exchange value, i.e. the capitalist produces things which he can give to you in exchange for something else, and that's called money. There was a time when you'd barter, you know. I'd make a table and you'd have a cow with milk and I'd swap my table for your milk. The modern economy clearly couldn't work on that basis. So it works on the basis of money. And these days it's not even paper money. It's a piece of plastic in your pocket, which is represents the money. The exchange value is created by producing goods that people need, such as the bread you eat every day, the milk you drink, the clothes you wear. Now, what's the relationship between the capitalist, the means of production, and the worker that is employed by the capitalist? Well, question. Does the capitalist pay a worker for the value of the goods he produces? That's the key question you have to ask yourself. Are the wages that you receive the equivalent of the value that you produce? If it was, there'd be no profit for the capitalist. He'd be a philanthropist. He'd be paying you out of the goodness of his heart to produce the goods that society needs. It's not like that. You see, everything in production, the raw materials, the machines to work on the raw materials, the transportation of the raw materials, throughout the whole process, everything has cost. Energy, the building of the factory, the electricity, the water, etc. But these are fixed prices. When you buy wood to produce furniture, you have to buy it at a fixed price. Another capitalist is selling that. You can't be flexible on that. But there's human labour, which has a particular characteristic. One, it's the only thing which adds new value because it transforms everything. Two, human labour power has the ability to produce values beyond what you directly need. What does that mean? Well, a worker, what does he regard as a decent wage? What will provide him with the money to be able to have a reasonable dwelling, a house, a flat, or something, with the furniture in it, to be able to pay the bills on that house, to be able to feed his children every day, to clothe them. Today, to go on holiday, to have a car, to have a TV. These are all things which people consider as reasonable demands, and they regard a wage that can satisfy that as a reasonable wage. Now, the point about human labour power, and this is what Marx pointed out, is what the capitalist buys is not what you produce. It buys your labour power. It's a bit like going back to the slavery. They don't buy you completely. Your slave belongs completely to the owners. He buys 8 hours of your day. And that means that during those 8 hours, whatever you produce no longer belongs to you, because that time, that labour power that you've given, has been bought. You've sold it away. And that means in those 8 hours, you work, whatever it is that you're producing, whether you're a coal miner, they still exist, maybe not so many in this country, or you're sitting at a computer, programming computers, or you're a designer, you know, whatever form of labour you do for an employer, there's a contract that says so much an hour, so many hours a day, so many days a week, etc. And there are conditions. Now, you've sold your time, those 8 hours. That means that whatever you produce in those 8 hours is not yours, because you've been bought. Your labour power has been bought, just as the wood has been bought, or the machines have been bought. But does a worker produce in 8 hours only the value of his wages? That's the question. Because if it was, going back to what I said before, if that were the case, there'd be no profit. But what Marx pointed out was that labour, because it creates new value, and he gave examples in his writings, that you work 8 hours, but the value of your wages have been, you've produced it in 4 hours. Now, that doesn't mean that you can clock off and say to the capitalist, well, I've produced my wages now, 4 hours, I'm off now, bye. That's not the way it works, and you'll find out that when you go to work. The capitalist say, no. 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock is when you can leave. Nowadays, not even that. It's 6, 7, 8 o'clock. You've got to stay for the whole time. That means that in reality, the old relationship of exploitation is still there, but it's hidden within the system. In the 8 hours, you produce far more value than the wages that you produce. Now, in this actually is one of the fundamental contradictions of the capitalist system. Because you see, you work 8 hours, 4 you produce your wages, the other 4 you're producing more value, but that belongs to the capitalist. That is where the profit comes from. That's the beauty of human labour power. It produces more value than it receives back in wages. But there's a problem on the other side of the equation here, which is to realise that profit, it's not enough to produce I don't know, 1,000 chairs. That's not where the profit comes from. The profit comes from selling the chairs. So you've got to start selling them on the market. Now, apply that to the whole of the economy. Take the millions and millions of workers, not just in Britain, but on a global scale, all of them, from the industrial workers to the office workers, etc., the farmers, etc., all of them put together are all producing value on a global scale. And they're doing it for somebody who appropriates it as his private property and then sells it on the market. And he's got to sell it, though, you've got to find people with money to spend. Now, it may seem banal what I'm saying, but sometimes when you read some economic journals, you think that the serious economists have forgotten these little details. You've got to sell the goods to people who can buy them. But there's a problem. If a worker in 8 hours has only been paid for the value of the 4 hours, and the other four belong to the capitalist, the worker is only earning wages which can actually buy back half of what he produces in this situation. If you multiply that by billions of people on a global scale, you see there is a huge contradiction between what the system can produce and wishes to sell and what the market can absorb. And this is a fundamental contradiction which is there at all times. Now, Marx pointed out that for a long period this can be hidden within the system. How? Well, for example, you guys are going to university, and a lot of you probably would not be able to afford to pay the fees, would you, from the wages of your parents? So how do you pay for it? They lend you the money. What a nice system. They give you the money out of the goodness of their hearts, £9,000 or whatever it is a year. You hand it over as fees. There's a problem. They didn't give it to you, did they? They lent it to you with interest. And when you start working, when you get to a certain level of income, you've got to pay it back. But it allows you to go to university. Now, it allows other people to do things like buy a house. What most people can't afford to buy a house, cash in hand. £200,000, £300,000, cash, hand it over. No. They save maybe 10, 20, 30,000 if they can, after they paid their loans. And then they go to a bank and ask for a loan. And the bank says, okay, 200,000, as long as you are earning such and such an amount, you want to buy a car. Most cars today are not bought cash by paying fully for them. You buy them on credit. You pay so much down in monthly payments. Now, credit is one of the solutions within the capitalist system that solves this contradiction, i.e., that amount of purchasing power, which the workers don't have immediately because they haven't got that amount of money coming in, is solved by the banks, which are part of the system, providing workers with that money. They can spend it. So you buy a house. What effect does buying a house have on the market as a whole? Well, it stimulates the market. Within each house, there's bricks, there's cement, there's wood, there's glass, the furniture that goes in, everything. This has a knock-on effect throughout the whole economy and keeps the economy going. Another way the system gets around the problem is the state. Because the state accumulates such a huge amount of capital through the taxation system, the state can spend money, build roads, build hospitals, build schools, employ teachers, etc., which in turn stimulates the economy because it creates people who have money to spend, etc. But Marx point, this is the thing where they say he was only partially right, because Marx pointed out that this mechanism, this setup, leads inevitably to crisis at some point. How? Well, the fact is we're in one now. We're in one hell of a crisis at the moment on a global scale. And what happened? Well, in the 70s, I've got the figures somewhere. If I can find the graph, it's quite a graphic one. If I find it. What it shows, this graph, if I find it later, I'll pull it out. That in the 70s, you had the beginnings of a crisis in the system. The way the capitalists got around that crisis was to massively increase productivity of labour. What does that mean? Extracting more and more value out of each worker without increasing the wages proportionally. Now, you can understand that if I apply technology to labour power, the same worker, £10 an hour, maybe in the old days was producing one chair an hour, I find a machine that some amazing engineer has developed which allows that worker to produce two chairs an hour. But I still give the worker only £10 an hour. But now I have two chairs instead of one. So I can sell that chair more cheaply on the market. That's the purpose of investing in capitalism and in technology. Because it makes my goods cheaper and I can sell more, undercutting the others. And because the capitalist system is based on competition between capitalists, all the capitalists are constantly seeking to cut their cost of production in order to cheapen their goods, in order to be more competitive. But in doing so, what did they do in the 70s? They took on the working class. We had Maggie Thatcher and Reagan and several other nice politicians on the international scene who went on the offensive against the working class in all countries, taking away a lot of their rights. And in the last 30 years, real wages have been more or less stagnant. But productivity has grown massively. The graphs show that. In that process, their profits have gone up. In the last 30 years, profits went up, and up until recently they were still going up. The increase in profits is achieved how? By actually reducing wages in proportion to the value produced. That's how you increase profits. Though you give the workers the same amount of money, or even a wage increase. You know, if you increase wages by 10%, but productivity is increased by 50%, you can see that what's happening is the workers, although each work, 10% is not bad, a wage increase, but they're producing much, much more. The fundamental contradiction between the ability to produce, i.e. the capacity to produce, and the ability of the market to consume that production, that contradiction grows even more. And in the last 30 years, what we've seen is a massive expansion of credit. And all of you have seen it and witnessed it. The ease with which they would give you credit cards until recently. And they were throwing money at people. And that kept the system going. Because if you give people money, give credit, people spend. They buy their TVs, their cars, etc. But clearly it has an effect on the overall economy, and the economy booms and keeps growing. Jobs are created, etc. But it's at a price. It's at a price. The credit reaches a point, it reaches a level, where it's no longer sustainable. And all of you know, if you're getting, I don't know how much you get these days in loans, how much do they give you a month to live off as a student? Anybody tell me? How much do you get? Does anybody actually get a loan? Are you all so well off that you don't have a loan? Well, let's say £1,000 is what you get a month. Not enough to live, so you have to get credit. You get the credit thinking you'll pay it off one day. Workers with credit cards. You know, today, there are families in this country who are actually using credit cards to pay for food. That's how bad the situation has become. But the credit hides the contradiction. It covers that gap that I referred to before. It provides the purchasing power. And so long as that's going ahead, there's a boom. Everybody seems to be quite happy. The system seems to be working. But the debt reaches a point where the level of interest is so high that you can no longer keep borrowing. You have to pay the interest back. And if the interest reaches too high a level, you reach the limit of what credit can do. And then credit actually turns into its opposite. Before, credit was providing expansion. Once it reaches the point where you have to pay so much back on your debt, that amount of money you're getting every month, part of it has to go back to the bank. It has to go to the bank as a repayment. So you might get £1,000, but you've got to spend 100 on your credit card, or 200, etc. That's less money in your pocket to spend. So it starts to unravel the other way. The market starts to contract. People start to concentrate on trying to pay their debts. The market goes down. Fewer goods are sold. People start losing their jobs. And even the value... You know, house prices go up and then they go down because people can't afford to pay those prices. So the credit only serves for a period, and it can go on for 10, 20, 30 years. But eventually, it reaches a point where the real contradiction appears. The other one is the state. In the post-war period, all states have had debts up to a point. And every debt is, you have to look at debt in relative terms. You know, if I earn £1,000 a month and I have a debt of 100, it doesn't concern me too much. I can easily either pay the interest or even pay it off. If I earn £1,000 a month and my debt is £10,000, I start to have a problem. I don't have enough money to service that debt. And what happens is the debt actually grows even if I don't borrow any more, simply because of the interest that's added. That's what's been happening to the debt of the state. In the past decades, the state has played a role. But in 2007 is when what Marx pointed out suddenly erupted in the eyes of millions, of billions of people on the planet, the banking crisis. Here we had all these banks, which were making money from money, suddenly facing collapse. Some of them did collapse. Some of the people working for these banks, with nice suits and ties, thinking that they were middle class, and not working class, suddenly were told to pick up their document, their papers from the desk and go, because the job was no longer there. Suddenly discovering that they weren't living in this marvellous world, whiz kid financial world, but they were without a job and had lost their means of survival. That crisis of 2007, how did the government respond? Well, can't let the banks collapse, can we? Well, that's what they say, we can't let the banks collapse, because that would mean a collapse of the whole system. So they gave the banks huge amounts of money, handed over huge wads of billions of pounds, of dollars, of euros, saved the banks. But then what happened? The public debt was enormously increased as a result, because the state had been spending money which it didn't have. And so you have debts, such as the debt of Italy, for instance. 120. The way they calculate how serious a debt is its ratio, its proportion to GDP, gross domestic product, which is what I was saying before. If your GDP is 100 and your debt is 30, it's manageable. If your GDP is 100 and your debt is 120, like the Italian one, that explains why we've got such a hell of a crisis in Italy at all levels. Or the Greek crisis. Greece cannot pay the debts. But until it worked, Greece was booming. Now it's in a terrible crisis. What happened? The government gave all the money over and then turns to all of us and says, we have a huge debt. And it has to be paid. Just like every family has to pay their debts, we have to pay the debts. How are we going to pay it? Well, we'll have to close the hospitals. We're going to have to sack teachers. Oh, students, £9,000 fees, by the way. And we don't know if that's the end of it. It was £3,000, and there was a time. You see, when I was a student, I didn't know there were such things as fees at university. You may be surprised. I didn't know because I never paid them. And I was never asked to pay them. The local council paid them automatically. And they also sent you a cheque every term, a nice little grant, which you didn't have to pay back. It wasn't a loan, it was a grant. You see how system has gone backwards, not forwards. That what I had at university was fought for by previous generations. My father was a steelworker. He went to work when he was 11. He was proud to have a son who could go on to university, and he didn't have to pay for it. Today, have we gone forward or gone backwards? The system is actually unravelling backwards. But the state is now cutting at all levels. Again, state expenditure, which in the past was a source of expansion for the system. Every hospital built, every road built, every school built, every group of government workers taken on. This was all expanding the economy. Now the government is doing the opposite. Now, this is capitalism, and it's creating a situation which... It's described in these articles, which I have here. Just a few. Growing demand for food banks in the country. A huge increase in the number of people who depend on food banks just to eat. Here's an example of Britain 2013. This is not Dickensian Britain. This is today. This is from Monday's Metro. And it describes how there's a growing number of people who are shoplifting for food. They're not shoplifting to sell the goods, as in the past you might have steal a TV or whatever if you can, or radio. I don't know what they did, but here it describes a police officer saying, it is often meat and cheese they steal, and it is for themselves and their family. Then it refers to a case. A 27-year-old woman from Blackburn was accused of stealing a tuna baguette worth £1.85. In court... You know how much it costs to take somebody to court? I've been, unfortunately, three times on a jury, and 2 weeks at a time, and you get paid your travel, you get paid your food, you get paid for all the work you lose, your two weeks' wages, and somebody was telling me, it can be £20,000 a day, you know, for £1.85. This system really has got its priorities right. While a 60-year-old man from Accrington allegedly stole instant mash and cheese worth £4 because they're hungry. This is Britain today. One in three Britons, the Independent, struggling to feed themselves. One in seven children go to school hungry, according to shock reports. And here in London, it depends on where you live, your life expectancy can be 18 years longer or shorter, depending on which part of London you live in. Now, it's not solely to do with the part of London you live in. It's to do with the fact that in some parts of London, people earn a lot of money, and in other parts, people earn less. And in some parts, people live in very nice houses, and in other parts, people live in slums in very terrible conditions. Now, this is a product of the crisis that we're in. Now, the question is, what is the alternative? That's the point. Unless we can offer an alternative, then the capitalists and their politicians will simply say, times are bad, we've all got to tighten our belts, this is it, and if we want to get back to the good old days, then you're all going to have to make some sacrifices. But of course, sacrifices don't work. The idea that we all tighten our belt, what does it mean? It means we spend less. Literally, in some cases, we eat less. We don't go on holidays often. Does that solve the crisis of capitalism? No, it doesn't. Because if everybody does that, the market collapses, and you sell less, and more jobs are lost in the process. Clearly, the solution is not that. Austerity is not solving the problem at all. It's imposed by the system, but it's not the solution. We would argue the solution is to break that fundamental contradiction which I referred to, which is, see, under capitalism, things are produced socially. What do I mean by socially? They're produced by the collaboration of many different people working together. From the people who sweep the floors of the factories, to those who run the machines, to those who transport them. Not just the, and I'm not just talking about the ones with the blue overalls and the oil and the spanners, but I'm also talking about the ones who control the computers and all the rest of it, all the nice clean jobs. You know? All of them put together produce the wealth. And it can only be produced socially. You show me a capitalist that produces his own goods. He has his own machines and he works them himself and he makes the money by not exploiting anybody. There's no such thing. He has to get hundreds and thousands of people working together socially. But there's a problem. The appropriation of what is produced socially is expropriated privately, i.e. it belongs to one individual or groups or small groups of people called capitalists who own the machines and the factories. Because they appropriate it privately, that's why we have this big contradiction in society and it leads to this crisis. That value, which is produced but is actually expropriated daily from the working class of the world, has to be put back into society under the control of the people who produce it. That's the point. Now, you see, they're prepared to take to court a woman who steals a baguette, a tuna baguette. She might as well have stolen something a bit more tasty or worth more, at least if you're going to take it to court for it, or at least two or three baguettes, make it worth it. But they're prepared to do that. Yesterday I was at the coach station, and I was standing in the queue, and I saw a police officer walk up to an individual simply because he looked Asian and said, "Hello, where are you going? How long have you been living here? Do you have any ID?" And I looked at him and I thought, this is what we read in the papers, how they're really harassing people on looking for illegal immigrants. They're the problem, you see. And that, again, policing costs a hell of a lot of money. They're all agreed they have to have nuclear missiles in this country. Labour, Tories and Liberal, they're all... Yeah, you need nuclear weapons, don't you? I mean, every day when you wake up in the morning, you say, where's my missile? Where's my trident? Right? I'm gonna launch it today. Now, we're all laughing, aren't we? We're all laughing, but they're there. Those missiles are there. And they're being produced, and they're spending billions and billions. On a global scale, I've got the figures here. If you take the spending of the USA, China, Russia, etc. on weapons, globally, 2.2%, something like $1.5 trillion worth of money, is spent on arms. That's the priorities of this society. Now, if you had a socialist society, which we aspire to working towards, imagine what you could do with $1.5 trillion. Not nuclear weapons, but schools, hospitals. You know, they talk about, we had to bomb Iraq, you see. Well, we all know why, because they had weapons of mass destruction. You still believe that? Now, if instead of doing that, instead of bombing them almost back to barbarism, the wealth they produced was used in a country like Iraq, for example, to provide enough food, housing, hospitals, you wouldn't have the problems that we have. We now have, you see what happened in Nairobi with the terrorists. This system is driving people crazy. They're absolutely fanatical. Some of them believe that if they do this, they'll go to heaven immediately as a consequence. And they're doing it pushed by situations like the ones we have in Somalia, which is barbarism already on this planet. And we have it in Syria. And in the Syrian war, by the way, Western companies are making big profits by selling arms to both sides. You know, business is business, you see. All that amount of wealth which is produced could be used in a different way. The same technology that is required to build a tank can build a tractor. Surely, in a lot of African countries, if we provided the tractors, we could immensely improve agricultural production. I remember in the 80s, the United Nations did a report on Ethiopia. At the time, I think the population was 30 million or something. Now it's about 60 million. It was at the time when there were these terrible famines that regularly happen in East Africa. Now, this UN report studied Ethiopia as a whole, the land of Ethiopia, and studied the potential that the land of Ethiopia had. And the conclusions they drew were that if they had pumps to pump the water from under the ground, pipes to take it where it's necessary, fertilizers, tractors, combine harvesters, and all the technique that goes with it, Ethiopia then could have produced enough food to feed 100 million people. That means more than enough for themselves and a huge surplus for other countries. At the time, I was living in Italy. And I remember being on a picket line outside a Fiat tractor factory. They were sacking workers who had the skill to produce tractors. And I remember thinking, this is a crazy system. Here are these skilled workers who know how to build tractors. And there in Ethiopia, there are people who need the tractors. What's stopping using these workers here to provide these people here with the means they need to feed themselves? Well, the answer is profit. Those people haven't got the money to buy the tractors. So, well, how do they make money? They dig by hand and wait for the rain to come. And if the rain doesn't come, nothing grows, and they go hungry. And they don't produce any money, and they can't buy any goods. Honestly, if you eliminate the profit motive and you have a rational plan of production on a global scale, you would say, we're going to employ these Fiat tractor workers to the maximum. We're going to produce all the agricultural machinery that people need. And we're going to send it to Ethiopia. And we'll have a deal. You raise your productivity. Italy's a country that doesn't produce enough food for itself. It's an industrialized country. Has to import. In exchange, we get food back. Now, wouldn't that be a much more rational system? The problem is, Agnelli, the owner of Fiat, says, oh, just a minute. I own this factory. And I'm not in business. I'm not a philanthropist. I don't do things for the good of people. I do it for profit. Well, the answer to that is, therefore, your time in history is gone. You've reached the point where you are no longer developing society. Your class, the capitalist class, has played a role, and Marx acknowledged the role of capitalism in developing the means of production, but he didn't see capitalism as the capitalists do. You know, a few years ago, a guy wrote a book called The End of History, and it was like, can you imagine the end of history? What comes after the end of history? I don't know, does it unravel? I don't know what happens after the end of history. I thought history continues on in the future. But the end of history, what did it mean? What it meant was we've reached the pinnacle of human development in terms of the type of society that we have. This is the best kind of society you can hope for. Look at what, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union and all the rest of it. they see capitalism as the end result of the whole historical process. And this is how it's going to be forever and a day. Marxists argue that capitalism is only one system in the historical development of humanity, just as feudalism was, and played a role, and slavery, terrible as it was, allowed for the civilization of Greece to develop, and the philosophers that we all study and quote, the Romans and all the rest of it. That civilization was based on the labor of the slaves. And it was progressive compared to the barbarism that was there was before. But each system has reached a limit and had to cede to a different system. Slavery ceded to feudalism, feudalism ceded to capitalism. Why should capitalism suddenly be the system which continues forever and a day? It's a system which has a role in history, but also has a limit. And what the great thing about it is it develops the productive forces and it creates the working class. But then the conditions are prepared by the crisis of the system to move to a different society, a more rational society, which can use the means of production that which we've accumulated. The technique. I'll just end on one thing. I don't know how old you guys are. You're probably 18, 20, 21, very young. I remember in the 70s watching a program called Tomorrow's World. And we're in Tomorrow's World now. Actually, we've gone beyond it because what they were predicting was supposed to happen, and it hasn't. There was a car, and the presenter of the show pointed out this car ran on water. You all know this is the case. It basically, it broke down the hydrogen and the oxygen, used it as forms of energy, and the end result out of the exhaust pipe was the recombination of the hydrogen and the oxygen, and it was water. And he actually took a glass, and he put it under the exhaust pipe to prove it, collected the drops, and drank them. And I was thinking as a kid, wow, what a fantastic world we're going to live in the future. No pollution from fossil fuels, no petrol and all the rest of it. It's going to be a fantastic world. Are we there yet? Why hasn't it happened? Somebody's profits are at stake here. That's the reason. Now, that's an example of how we could have a completely different kind of society, a rational society, not a society that goes backwards in terms of technology, but forward, but uses technology to develop the means of production in a harmonious way, i.e. in harmony with nature and not against it. We're actually, capitalism is actually destroying the environment in which we evolved. We are still fundamentally the same animals that we were 200,000 years ago, physically. And we evolved in certain conditions, and we evolved to live in a certain type of atmosphere, not to breathe the things that we're breathing now. But it's getting worse all the time. So this system, not just threatens the livelihood of people, it's actually threatening the planet itself. So socialism is not just about wages and conditions, you know, it's not about working class and, you know, the cloth cap and all the rest of it. It's about the very future of humankind. Can this planet sustain this system the way it works, or do we need to fundamentally change it in order to be able to live in harmony with nature and move forward at the same time on the technological level? And we believe it is possible, but it requires a completely different running of the economy, which means you have to expropriate the capitalists. They expropriate the expropriators, as one comrade said once, because they expropriate the workers every day. We need to take it back, use it rationally, and there's immense potential for the development of humanity. And as Marx pointed out, the future is either socialism or barbarism. Barbarism is in our midst today. I don't know if you're reading the Evening Standard about the gangs in London. Started yesterday. I suppose they must be. They don't even have to sell it, do they? So they're frightening people to death in London, basically, through those articles. But it shows you, even in London we have this level of barbarism, but it's nothing compared to what we have in Syria or Somalia or the Congo. 5 million people killed in the Congolese wars. Do you hear about it? Is it in the headlines? Far more killed than have ever been killed in Syria. Why are they not highlighting the wars that have taken place in the Congo? Because they're proxy wars between different armies over control of the mines. There is literally slave labor in those mines at gunpoint. They're forced to work to dig out coltan, which is in all your mobile phones. And the proxy armies are backed either by the Japanese or the Americans or the British or the French. They're fighting each other over the control. In the meantime, 5 million blacks. I suppose they're blacks for the majority of white capitalists. They don't exist hardly as a statistic. But that's happening today. It doesn't have to be like this. It can be different. And that's what we would argue. And there's not enough time here to go into all the details. There's lots more meetings that we plan to have. You know, what socialism would be like is something that we can discuss more in depth. We can also discuss things like what the Soviet Union was. We would argue it wasn't socialist. It was a bureaucratic dictatorship, etc. But it's not time to discuss that in detail, but that can be another discussion itself. There's lots of things that flow from this discussion which you can develop. What I would invite you to do is, I don't know if I've convinced you or not. I'm sure I've not convinced everybody. My experience tells me that. But I hope that I've stimulated your interest in what Marxism is, how capitalism works, what the alternative is. And it's an interest to come to further meetings in the society and deepen your understanding of what's happening in the world and also get involved in the struggle to change it. But we're not talking just for the sake of talking. We're analysing and we're proposing ideas because we actually want to change the world. That's the point that Marx made. Philosophers so far have interpreted the world. The point is to change it.
Thanks very much, Fred, for your brilliant lead-off. A couple announcements before we go into the discussion, which I forgot to make. After this meeting, we'll be following on to the pub, and everyone is welcome to come along with us. I think we're going to the Huntley, which is just in the corner from Gower Street, a few minutes away from here. So if you just follow us after the meeting, we'll take you there. Also, Comrade Stella wanted to make a few words about the Marxist Student Federation and also to pass the sign-up sheet along.
Oh, yes.
To sign you up to the mailing list, unless you have done so already.
So, basically, first of all, if you guys are interested and we haven't got your email earlier this morning, because as you saw in the program that we handed you out, they're not venues and hours to the meetings, so we have to let you know where the meetings are. So if you're interested and you haven't given us your contact details, please do now. That's the thing going, pass it around. Then the other thing, I don't have them. The other thing that I wanted to talk about a little bit is our Marxist Federation, Student Federation. The IMT, the International Marxist Tendency, stay building Marxist student societies across universities. And now we've reached the point, we thought, that we are big enough, the crisis is deep enough. Every time we go into uni, we find, today, more and more people interested in Marxist ideas. And we have set up societies in something 20 universities across the country. So we have decided to get all of us involved into a whole encompassing kind of entity, the federation, which you haven't officially set up yet. This is our manifesto. I can I don't know. We only have those two copies.
Read out where it stands.
So yeah, and it's our manifesto has a short introduction, and then we have a few points. Of how we have decided of moving into the student movement and what our presence should be. So yeah, it would be oppose all cuts to education, oppose all fees, and actively campaign for free education for all, campaign for massive program on investment in education, campaign for the abolition of student debt, oppose obscenely high pay for university management. University should pay should be democratically run by elected representatives of the students and staff unions on the wages of skilled workers.